This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Sergeant and Mrs. Smith, you are going to love this house.
Is that a tub in the kitchen?
There's no field manual for finding the right home. But when you do, USAA Homeowners Insurance can help protect it the right way. Restrictions apply.
Forever. Dog.
Listeners, welcome to Relatively Healthy. I'm Janie Stoller, and today we are talking about organ transplants and organ donors, and I am so pleased to bring on one of my favorite people, Jesse Galley, who I met at the UCB a million years ago. He's a funny, wonderful, awesome person, and after getting to know him, I learned that he was the recipient of a heart transplant, and I think he's great evidence of the life you can live after you've received an organ. And proof that organ donation is a very important and special thing. So I hope you like it. Today on Relatively Healthy, I'm joined by one of my favorite people. And it's weird because he's a straight man. And that's really rare for me. I mean, we have producer Brett, who's another icon, John Legend, Barack Obama. It's such a short list. And Jesse is definitely on that list. Jesse, hello.
Hi, Janie.
Hi. How does it feel to be on the list?
It feels good to be on the list.
Good, good. So, Jesse, I'm having you on the show today because not only are you one of my favorite people, but I've known you for a while now. And it wasn't until maybe a few months into being your friend that I found out that you had had a heart transplant, and there was no way to know. It was sort of this thing where I was like, oh, you've been living this life and you have this story. And I think a lot of people don't know that the people in their lives could have had organ transplants. And secondly, I get really pissed off when people say they're not registered to donate their organs. So I thought this would be a very good topic for today's show. So thank you so much for being on.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
I'm so happy you're here. So to start off, can you tell us a bit about your health story? So what was your health like and your relationship to your body growing up and what happened?
What was my relationship to my body growing up?
Yeah, specifically during puberty. Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess very broadly speaking, so I didn't have any pre-existing conditions. I was very healthy growing up. I was very active. I played a lot of sports. You know, I'm the youngest of four boys. All three of my older brothers played sports. So like, it was just kind of part of the deal. Like I, you know, it was part of the deal. So growing up, I didn't even really think about it. It was just, I was active. I played baseball. I played basketball. I played football. I was, you know, that's just kind of how my life was growing up. You know, so that was, I guess my relationship with my body growing up was, I won most athletic in eighth grade.
Hell yeah.
I wasn't like the best athlete, but I was decent, but I was, wait, that sounds really bad, to say that, but no. I didn't have any, I grew up very healthy. I had nothing wrong with me. What was the second, say again, the second thing?
So what happened? Cause I remember you telling me the story that it, like your health stuff kind of started out of nowhere.
Yeah. So, again, so I grew up this, like with no, physically no issues. I went away to my freshman year of college. So I grew up in Pennsylvania, on the eastern side of Pennsylvania. I went to Pittsburgh for my freshman year of college. And then I came back that summer, after the freshman year, and, you know, sort of a long story short, I was feeling sick. I was like very short of breath. And I remember like taking like this random trip to Montreal with a couple of my close friends that summer. And it got to I was really sick, but I didn't know how sick I was. I remember being in Montreal and I couldn't walk a block without being out of breath. Mm. I just was very sick. I don't want to get too graphic about it, but it was nothing like I've ever felt before. I was like on my friend's back. He was like walking me like blocks. It was like this thing, but because I was so healthy and so active and I'd never had anything wrong with me growing up, it was just, I wasn't really paying attention about it. And I was 19 at the time, you know, I was after my freshman year of college. So I was this young person who, you know, was getting ready to go live in my first apartment, you know, after, you know, once the second year started of college. But it turned out that I was in heart failure, but I had no idea. So I was a bit naive and I didn't let things go too long, but, I had trouble sleeping. I was very sick and I was having trouble breathing. And ultimately I went to the emergency room. And the doctor, after they ran a bunch of tests, they took an x-ray of my chest and my heart was like the size of like a grapefruit or something.
Oh my God.
And then they called the on-call cardiologist. They came in and they were like, you're in heart failure. Your heart is functioning at less than 10% of its capacity, which is obviously not a very good thing. So I was not in good shape at the time.
Wow.
And then I literally found myself in a hospital in Philadelphia the next day being put on the transplant waiting list. So it was very quickly that I, my life changed very quickly.
Wow. That's like essentially crazy.
Overnight. Like I knew I was not feeling well, but I just remember we have to put him on the transplant list.
That's insane.
Yeah, it was tough.
Because I can imagine, I mean, like you were saying, a healthy person walking around, you get the flu. Okay, sure, I can shake it off and sure, I'm really sick, but whatever. And then it just got to that point and no one thinks they're going to have to deal with this. This is totally crazy. So what does it mean to be on the transplant list? Like, how do they explain it to you when they're telling you that?
Well, I mean, I think in some ways I benefited by being so young and the fact that I didn't have like some congenital issue or like that I had this thing with me with my entire life, the fact that it happened so fast and like that almost in a way helped me because it kind of like forced me to like get in the situation very quickly, and to kind of adapt very quickly. And I think that was really helpful. So being on the waiting list, I mean, I didn't know, like I knew nothing about this. Like I was, yes, I had my driver's license. I put organ donor on my driver's license. That was essentially like all I knew about organ donation. Mm-hmm. It's like when I was 16, when I got my driver's license, that's what I put on. So it was just, because it happened so quickly, I was so naive and it was almost better that way. Does that make sense?
That does. I think people who understand how long those lists can be and the complications that can go into being a recipient, it can be horrible. So it sounds like not knowing all of those details was actually psychologically beneficial at the time.
Yeah. And so what happened, like, basically an unknown virus attacked my heart and destroyed some of the muscle tissue. It's called a viral cardiomyopathy.
Mm-hmm. And it can happen to anyone, right?
It
could happen to anyone?
It could happen to anyone. Yeah. So no one can be sure when or where I got the virus. I mean, but ultimately I needed a heart transplant. Mm-hmm. So instead of returning to college, you know, I found myself in this hospital hooked up to a bunch of monitors in the cardiac care unit. And just waiting. Then that's when I got to kind of digest things more. Like once I started waiting for the fact that I needed to wait for the transplant. So the initial thing was like a shock and I was kind of forced in the situation to think about things that, I think most people don't until later in life, but, then, you know, the waiting game, you know, is not that I didn't even mean to reference the waiting game, but that's when I kind of started to think about things more.
And how long was that phase? How long were you waiting?
So I was very lucky I didn't wait that long. And there's different factors that go into that. And I will say that, like, my own experience is, it's really like everyone has their own experience in terms of transplantation. So other recipients are going to say different things or wait different times. So this is really just true to me, and my personal experience. I had a rare blood type, which is a factor in terms of how you get matched, how sick I was at the time. So, I mean, a lot of these bioethical questions in terms of like how you allocate organs and things it's very interesting things, which is, you know, I know this is like a short podcast or a shortish podcast, but I was lucky. I was only in the hospital for a few months.
A few months.
So what today is August 19th. Mm-hmm. So this time, 17, almost 18 years ago. So this August 5th was the day that I went into the hospital to wait and got put on the transplant list.
Are you serious?
So this time, yeah. So when you asked me to be on this podcast,
yeah,
I realized that this time at that point I was waiting for a heart transplant.
Wow.
I was sitting in the hospital, and I literally couldn't leave the hospital until I received the transplant.
I mean, you're saying only a few months, and it's so much longer for a lot of people, but that still sounds like such a long time to not know what's going to happen and to just sit in the hospital, especially you're a 19-year-old and your whole life is just turned upside down all of a sudden. That feels like forever.
Yeah. Again, I going back to the fact that it was like very sudden, I think helped me. Mm-hmm. And I was naively just kind of knew that I had this weird gut thing that I was like, oh, I'm going to get a heart. Like, it's going to happen. And I'm going to get, I just really wanted to get back to the normalcy of life. I wanted to get back to the life that I thought I was going to live. Like, I just kind of knew it was going to happen. And like, that was naive. And like, it's not true for a lot of people, because a lot of people, like, unfortunately don't make it to that. But for me, I just knew that was going to happen. So maybe I was tricking myself. But I was very positive and confident that I was going to get a heart, which, you know, thankfully I did.
Yeah. Do you remember the day they told you they had a match and that you were getting the transplant?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's, there could be a whole podcast, I think, just about my experience waiting in the hospital, you know, for this. And things have changed. This was, again, so September 8th is the anniversary of my second birthday. Mm-hmm. And you know, that time waiting was very interesting. And, you know, I had a roommate and I was by far the youngest person. I was in the adult wing, even though, you know, I was 19 but most of the people were like older men who kind of, you know, maybe abused their lives a little bit too much, and whatnot. But they referred to me as the kid, you know, in the wing. So it was, that whole experience was very interesting.
Because the whole wing is people waiting for organs.
At the time. So again, I'm not an expert of how things are now. Mm-hmm. So I just want to speak to how it was when I was there. So because of how sick I was, like, I needed to be in the hospital. So I was what they call like a 1A. So again, my heart was functioning less than 10%. I was dying. I was at the top of the list. Let's just say that. So I needed a heart. I needed a heart. Mm-hmm. Or I was going to die. And I knew that, and they were very, you know, and my family knew that, my friends knew that. And it was in many ways more difficult on the people around me than it was on me, I think, in many ways. Mm-hmm. What was interesting is, like, the day before I actually had my heart, I finally had sort of, lack of a better word, like a breakdown. I had a roommate who was an older man in his 50s. I went to the bath. I got very overwhelmed, but I went into the bathroom and I went into the hospital bathroom and breakdown. It all kind of like hit me. It finally hit me. Mm-hmm. Like, I was, you know, had a chance to kind of digest things, and it hit me. And then a dear friend of mine, came down. So her birthday, September 7th, came down on her birthday, and this is a true story. And when she was leaving, because, like, you know, after visiting hours, like, they let it fly. They let you stay a little bit later, you know, for people who were, like, I was basically living in this hospital.
Mm-hmm.
I said to her, I was like, you know, for your birthday, I'm going to get a new heart. So she went home that night. And then around 11 o'clock, I was sitting in my bed, and, you know, one of the doctors came and was like, there's a heart available for you. Please, you know, call your parents and tell them to come down.
Wow.
And like, you have to be in the operating room in 45 minutes, essentially.
45 minutes. Wow.
And I was like, okay. And I was like, that's the crazy thing is, like, you're waiting and waiting.
Oh my
God. And
there's
people who, at the time when I was there, who were waiting like months and months, like, you know, like 9 months. And that's what I mean. Like, you know, I was very lucky. I didn't have to wait that long.
Wow.
So just like, that's like, hey, there's a heart, like, you need to go down.
And you don't even have time to digest that. You just got to go. Yeah.
Like, because you don't know. Right.
Right.
So, like, unfortunately, you know, you can't be a living donor and give someone a heart. Right.
Right.
So someone dies, and you're going to ultimately benefit from that generous gift.
Yeah.
So I call my parents who live like an hour, like a little over an hour from the hospital, and they sped down. They did make it there, like, as I was getting, like, wheeled into the operating room. So I did get to, like, you know, say hello to them.
Oh my God.
I was very, like, drugged up at the time, I'm sure.
I can't imagine what they were going through. I can't even imagine that.
That's what I think it was probably much, much harder on them than it was on me.
Yeah.
Because they gave me sedatives and things like that to relax me. So I was, like, cracking jokes, like, on the way down. A very special thing, too, though, because everyone at the time, this was happening, you know, there was all these other people who were waiting. So it was this really special thing. Like, once, you know, someone got the call, as you were coming out, all the other people who were waiting would come out, like, they would wake everybody up, or depending on when it was. And, like, they came around me, and they, you know, they said a prayer around me, and, like, it was just a very touching thing. And I went down, and I was like, hopefully I, not to be weird or real, but I was like, hopefully I wake up, you know?
Right, right.
So obviously things went well. The surgery went well.
I had
a wonderful match.
Like you were saying, the organ has to be new. So they get the organ, they take it out, and immediately they do the surgery. How, like, it just feels like there's a lot of, it's a race against the clock, that whole procedure. And then how long did it take? Do you remember, like, how long you were under and how long the procedure was?
So again, it's really dependent on the person, on the situation. I was very lucky. From what I recall, I think mine was about 6 hours long.
Wow.
Which is actually not that bad, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a surgeon. I'm not a doctor, for the record.
I know, but, like, I think about all the complications and all the little pieces of a heart. I'm like, I don't fucking know how you do that.
You know what? There's, you know, from my understanding, there's actually other heart surgeries that are much more intricate and much more difficult than a heart transplant.
Oh.
I was young, and they kept it very simple for me. They're like, yeah, you know, it's like, we pop one out, we pop a new one in, you know, it's just a kind of very...
I love that, pop out and pop in as the terminology in the medical
textbooks. And you also have to remember, like, don't forget, like, I was 19 at the time, and I didn't have any other things going on. So my body was very healthy. Like, even while I was waiting for the heart, I was doing, like, physical therapy. I would ride a bike. I would do laps around, like, the hospital wing. Like, I was, as much as my body would let me do it, but there was nothing else wrong with I was healthy otherwise.
Yeah.
So, like, youth definitely is a factor. So in terms of, like, I think how well the surgery goes and also at how well you bounce back from the recovery.
That makes sense.
So if you have other things happening or if you have other issues going on, it's going to make things more complicated. The fact that I was 19 and in good shape otherwise, like, really the only thing that was wrong with me is my heart was screwed up.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a huge benefit to me. In terms of how well I did.
And then do you remember when you woke up? Do you remember that?
I do.
Yeah.
I remember when I woke up, which is so insane. I mean, the whole thing is insane.
It's insane.
And God bless my friend. He was one of my closest friends, and two of my friends had come to visit me, not knowing this was going to happen. Because you don't know. That's the thing. It's like you just no one knows. Like you're wait as you're waiting, like you have no idea when this is going to happen, right? Like,
yeah.
It's this weird thing. Like, there's this weird morbid thing. It's like when like certain holidays come around, when people like drive more, and maybe there's an act, like. You kind of like have these weird dark thoughts in your head. It's like, oh, there's more accidents during Labor Day. Like maybe I'll get it. Maybe I'll get a chance. But anyway, my friends, they came up, but they just happened to like randomly come the day that I got it. So they were like, I'm sure totally freaked out. But I remember waking up and I'm being like, oh, okay. All right. I'm alive. And, but I was like hooked up to all kinds of things. And, you know, I had there was a tubes everywhere. I couldn't really talk. I don't want to get too, granular about the details, but I was just like, okay, I'm alive. Like at least the surgery worked. So like, that's one step.
Mm-hmm. And then that's not, what's weird too, is like, that's not the end, right? I mean, once you've had the transplant, then you start a whole new life. Like there's a whole new chapter that begins at that point, right?
Yeah. I mean, that is, arguably like the fulcrum of my life at that point, right? When I had a transplant. And what's funny is when, we talked about doing this podcast, or when you invited me to be on the podcast, is I just realized that I've spent essentially half of my life now as a transplant recipient.
Wow.
So I was 19 at the time. My 18th second birthday again in September, I turned 38 in November. So like basically half of my life has been as a recipient.
Wow.
And, so there's, it's something that I had to learn on my own.
Mm-hmm.
It was helpful to have people come and talk to me and like other people who have had transplants, and that was nice. But I really think for me, it was something that I had to go through on my own and experience. In terms of the initial acute recovery, which is the most important part.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, many things can go wrong. It's someone else's heart that's going into your body, so there's definitely complications. So the follow up, and so I was in the hospital for 10 days after the transplant, and then I got discharged.
What?
To my parents. Yeah, which is like, again, very quick. I got very upset.
Yeah, wow.
I don't want to say this is like necessarily the norm. Maybe it is. I don't know.
But that's just crazy too, to think about all the time you spent in the hospital, you had the heart, and then 10 days later, it's like, now you're back in the world. That's crazy.
Yeah. So, I mean, but you're following up every week. You get biopsies to make, so make sure your heart's, you're not rejecting the heart and things like that. You spend this time waiting, then you get it, and like it's this whole other thing. So it's also like mixed emotions. So you're very happy to like receive a heart, but then like you also think about this person who died, and it's a very weird time.
Mm-hmm.
But I was so happy to just be out of the hospital, just be at home. I was so happy to like not have to piss in a bottle. Sorry. Like I just like I can actually go to the, like when I got home, it was very nice to just be in a normal bathroom, like be in my actual bed, have like my pillows around, like, I was just so happy to just, again, like my whole goal was just get back into my normal life. And that's the whole point. Like it works. And I just wanted to get back into my normal life.
That's
so it sounds so trivial, but like I just said, like, the fact that I could go home and like just go to the bathroom in a toilet instead of like going in a bottle to see like how much water I was, or how much fluid I was retaining, like this little dumb stuff like that. I was just very happy to be home.
Yeah.
And very lucky again to not have the complications that some people do have.
Yeah. So then you were going and you were getting biopsies and you were getting tests consistently, but what did they tell you for like long term in terms of what to expect and the kind of care you'd have to take for your heart and for yourself that were different than before?
It's a really great question. It's I you know, for me initially, again, this is 18 years ago at this point, or almost 18 years ago. For me, I was just happy to be, I was like, okay, if I get to 5 years, that's great. Like, you know, am I on borrowed time? Like, and then like I hit 5 years and I was like, then I hit 10 years and I had like my 15th anniversary. Then, you know, like in September, it'll be 18 years. It was, you just don't know. Like you don't know. And like, there's advancements that I'm forever grateful that I'm alive in a time like when this can exist.
Yeah.
So if I had the same thing happen to me, like in the '70s or like early '80s, like I'd be dead. So like the fact that this happened to me then and the drugs that are available and the surgical techniques that are available to keep me alive, I was very, very lucky that, you know, in with modern medicine that to help me to be alive, to be honest.
Yeah.
So in terms of long-term, so no one knows, even to this day, I don't know. I mean, Jane, do you know how long, like, how long do you think you're going to live? Like,
not long. I don't know.
I mean, honestly, like I don't know. I mean,
but
have
you
this
still
thing
consistently
that,
go to the doctor, right? Like this is something that you go to and they tell you right now, this is what things are looking like. Like for the rest of your life, you will do that. And do you take medicine too?
Yeah. So I take the medicine is my lifeline.
Mm-hmm.
So I take anti-rejection medicine every day, twice a day. It keeps me alive. If I stopped taking that medication, I would die.
That's so crazy to like imagine that this organ has been in your body for 18 years and that you still need to take medicine. I mean, that just says so much about how the human body works that you still need to take anti-rejection medicine every day. That's crazy.
For the rest of my life.
For the rest of your life.
For the rest of my life.
Yeah.
Yeah. The dosages have lessened and like the amount of drugs that I've taken or that I take has lessened over the years because I've done well. And my body has adjusted more to the transplant, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know my body probably much more than I would have if this didn't happen to me, arguably. I mean, who knows, but I like to think that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I do have to take medicine twice a day, and it sort of tricks your body into thinking that it's your own heart, and there's complications that come from the medicines. I mean, like that's other things, you know. So I'm technically, you know, I'm immunosuppressed.
Mm-hmm.
So my immune system is not like yours. Actually, I don't know. Maybe other people have other immune system issues, but so I'm, again, like initially, like you're way more, your immune system is more, way more suppressed, and it's much more acute initially. You know, now it's not as, you know, again, as it's 18 years, so I'm on less drugs, but I still am more susceptible to getting like different, you know, getting colds, or maybe like a cold will last a little bit longer for me than they maybe would for you, or, you know, transplant recipients are more prone to developing certain types of cancer, like basal cell carcinoma, like certain skin cancers or things like that. So there are things that I, you know, or there's side effects to the drugs that I take, I guess, is what I will say.
And just being more cautious. And I remember, too, you told me a story, not to name names, but we were on an improv team together. And I think someone jumped on you and you didn't say anything. But like it sounded from the way you told the story, like people shouldn't be jumping on you. Not to name
names. People could say. No. They said that. Like this person in the audience.
Oh, they heard and then were like, oh shoot,
no,
I should.
People can jump on me all they want. That's it.
Okay. Okay. Okay.
Well,
so that's good.
I mean, I don't want to be jumped on. But I, you know. First of all, that was a great scene, I will say.
Worth it, whatever the consequence. Okay, so just I'm glad we cleared that up.
A really deep dive into like a specific improv scene from a show from like 10 years ago.
Yeah, we could talk about all of our old improv scenes. People love it, even if they just happen. They're so interesting. Okay, so I'm glad we set the record straight. People should jump on you.
I guess the other thing I want to say is like everything that I should do, other than like taking these like specific my specific medication or like my follow-up routine with my doctor is like anything anyone should do.
Like, right. Like not eat fried
either.
Food
like,
all
I
the time.
Mistakes. Like,
yeah.
I'm very, very vigilant with my medication routine. And I'm also like more vigilant with probably what my body than some people probably think, but But things that I do, like you, like everybody should do, like it's just eating healthy, like exercising, like it's just stuff like everyone should do. It's
right.
Not, you know what I mean? Not to make like simplify things too much, but that's really that's the truth.
Yeah. Just being trying to live a healthy life and not smoke and just, you know, the stuff everyone should do. That makes sense.
So, yeah. I mean, so that will help my life. My rule was always like, I'll do what my doctors tell me. Yes. You can jump on me, I guess, is
the conclusion.
You can title the podcast that. You can jump on me.
You can jump on me. You mentioned that it's weird. I'd imagine it's weird with the donor and knowing that this person died and you have their organ. I'm sure there's so many feelings and thoughts that go into that. What options do they give you for either knowing about the donor or knowing about their family or being in touch? Like, how does that work?
So it's a very anonymous thing. Mm-hmm. I think for obvious reasons. When I received the transplant, I was told you're told very little. It's kept very anonymous. I know very, very basic details about the situation. What's called organ procurement agencies, organizations around the country. Like each region has their own. There's a national one as well, who are responsible for allocating organ transplants. And working with them, they help facilitate kind of connections between recipients and the donor families. So I, was very, and still forever grateful and thankful for the second chance of life, write letters to my donor family.
Mm-hmm.
And I've written many letters over the years. But both parties have to agree to meet in order for that to happen.
Mm.
And in my specific situation, we have never met. We have never met.
I mean, I'd imagine, how does it feel to write those letters? Like, do you feel, you must feel gratitude, but does it make you feel good to know this person's life has this, carries on this extra sort of life, beyond their death? Like, I'd imagine there's responsibility or feeling of responsibility in that and privilege.
Yeah. I mean, this is one of the hardest things that I struggle with, I think, I don't know if it's an actual thing. I use the phrase like transplant recipient guilt. Like, mm-hmm. I'm not doing it. Like, I got the second chance at life. I'm not doing everything that I can to do it. I'm not like being this and that, and like doing all these amazing things. But I also think that like I opted into living a life that not necessarily defined by my transplant. And I've done lots of things and I've, traveled. And for me, it's just living a normal life and like just doing the thing, like doing the normal things that anyone would do. Is I would like to think that my donor or my donor family would like that.
Yeah. Also, so like, you're doing more than normal. But we don't have to get into that.
Because it's been so long for me, and I again get back into the repetitiveness of normalcy of life. That's when I feel I get this like guilt. But then it's like, no, that's part of like normal life. Like that's what life is. And like if I, I'd like to think that donor families maybe like, and I don't want that, this heart has been with me, for 18 years. And, a few days ago, I just got back from, Paris and London. I gave a toast at a wedding in London to a friend that I met doing a study abroad. This all happened after I had the transplant.
Wow.
Yes, I've made mistakes and I've done, and things, other things happen and I get caught up with like the dumb stuff of life, but I'm also like, this heart is coming with me and doing all and traveling with me and like doing all these things that this person who graciously gave me this gift, unfortunately didn't get a chance to do.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know if I answered your question.
No, that definitely answers it. I mean, also like, not to talk too much about your life, but you do lead an extraordinary life and you're a really good person and you help people. So I think, you know, it's one thing if you like, you know, you're living your, I am not going to say it as well as you just did. And it's also your own experience, but I just don't think you live a simple, normal life. I think you live a great one. Anyway, but do you hear from them too?
I don't.
Yeah.
Which is totally fine.
Yeah. I just can't even, I mean, like it must in your mind, you just live your life and it honors them. And
that's all that matters.
That's all that matters. Yeah.
It makes, I like the write, you know, I don't write as much as I probably should, but I can't imagine what they went through. You know, I'm on the opposite side. It's again, going back to that, when we were talking about, like when it initially happened, like, you know, the day after someone just like their loved one just died.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So this is the 18th anniversary coming up in September of my transplant. But on the other hand, like that's the 18th anniversary of someone's passing. Right. So
yeah.
It's this weird, dichotomy. Does that work? Is that
yeah.
where it works? Is that,
yeah. It's weird though, because I think a lot of times, I guess when there's an anniversary of a death too on the other side, not to say how these people feel, but I know you wonder, am I doing enough to honor their legacy? Am I, you know, what part of them lives on and what's, you know, what exists past the death? And then to think about their organ literally giving someone else life and the thing that gave them life, giving someone else a chance at life, I'd imagine is... it gives a lot of meaning to their life 18 years later. Cause I just think like, I mean, we're getting into it now, but like, I don't understand why people aren't organ donors. It's so easy to do and you can enable people to live wonderful, healthy, normal lives versus having your organs, you know, rot. Like, I don't get it. But it just feels like after someone dies, there's a lot of questions of like, what do I carry on? What's the meaning? What is this? It just feels like such an easy way to ensure that at least some part of you will have a positive effect on the people who are alive.
Listen, yeah, it's very sad. So I don't think it's like, oh, someone has to die for me to live, right? Like
mm-hmm.
I didn't. It's like to be kind of like logical about it. Like they're going to die anyway.
Right. Right.
So like, you're going to die. Like, why not? Like me personally, and this is no knock to anybody or what other people's beliefs. It's an organ. It's tissue. Like you can, it's one of the easiest things you can do to save a life. And like, what's greater than saving a life? Like, you know, it transcends. Like, or like, and it sounds so kind of cheesy, but like on the inside, like we're kind of all the same. So it transcends race, religion, like gender, you know, like you can, man, I could have a female, like it doesn't matter. Like all that doesn't matter. It's mm-hmm. you're saving someone's life. You, unfortunately there's a tragedy but somebody else can benefit from this tragedy.
Yeah,
and,
especially
being one of you, and go on to live a normal and healthy and wonderful life. Like it's just an amazing thing. And yeah, sorry.
Yeah, I know that that's exactly what I wanted to hear your opinion on. Because I guess if an organ is viable for transplant, that means it's likely not someone who, you know, died at 90. That's like the reality is that it's someone who has a healthy enough organ to be transplanted. So what a horrible thing that person passed away, but what a small, incredibly powerful thing to be an organ donor and then know that there's a part of your tissue that can do what you were just saying, help someone live a normal life. So, I mean,
it's amazing.
Yeah. Like maybe it's also,
Sorry, Jenny. Go ahead.
I was thinking. I mean, I think sometimes it's just psychological. People are freaked out by the idea of checking organ donor on their driver's license because it's like they're thinking about death. But I think they need to get over it.
I think they do too. I mean, I personally think it should be an opt-out situation, which is not the case in the United States.
Yeah, like, I think in some countries it's opt-out.
In Europe, it's like, I know in the UK, it's like, I don't want to, please don't hold me up as an expert on all this stuff, but there's a lot of myths out there about organ donation. I will say, one takeaway is like, if you think you're too old or if you think you're not eligible to be like, please stop. Like anyone, just please register to become an organ donor. Like, and no matter if you think you are eligible or not, like, I think everyone should just do it. And also talk to your family about it, because I think that's important as well. Because ultimately, your next of kin can make the final decision. So I think it's not only registering and becoming an organ donor, but also talking to your family about it. And I, you're talking about this, I think, before we maybe were rolling, but it's people need to be inspired to make those decisions sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And if this conversation or if another story that you're reading out there, like, hopefully that'll just inspire people to just register to become an organ donor, talk to your family about it. Like, it's very simple. It's very easy. You can help people. You can save a life.
You can save a life.
Lives, not even one life. You can save multiple lives.
And I also, to clarify too, I think something you were saying is, like, I think there's a lot of misinformation about it. I think sometimes people think it's the same as donating your body to science, which is a completely different thing. And I think people have weird ideas about what happens when you sign up to be an organ donor. It's pretty fucking normal. And like, there's no weird, I mean, there's a really good book about donating your body to science, which is a whole other thing. It's called Stiff by Mary Roach, but it is not that, just to clarify. And yes, like you were saying, they can take multiple organs. So if you are like, oh, I have a bad whatever, the doctors are qualified to figure out if there's an organ that's viable and let them make that decision for you.
Yes. There's a lot that goes on behind the scenes. No one's like harvesting your organs. So like, it's crazy. Like,
yeah. If you think about like all of the steps you had to go through to get an organ. I mean, it's not like this is a willy nilly, like, they're making very sound decisions here about what organs they're taking.
No, the transplant team is totally separate than the team that is trying to save your life. Like, God forbid you get into an accident or, you overdose on something, like they're trying to save your life.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you're in the intensive care unit, like, someone is trying to save your life.
Yeah.
The transplant team is like, they're a different team. You know, an interesting fact for me is that, like, most people who do die, like are not suitable for organ donation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can still donate like bone and skin and like your corneas. That's other things to remember. Like, it's not just about solid organs, like, kidneys, liver, heart, lung, et cetera. You can donate your skin, you can donate your bone. Like, it's every myth is like essentially dispelled, mm-hmm. That people have about organ donation.
Yeah. What are some of the things you hear? Like, what are the like stupid things that people say to you or misinformation you hear?
The stuff that I hear, I don't hear that many stupid things, I will say. People are, again, I kind of hinted at it earlier, like their soul or something,
That stuff.
It's tissue. It's an organ.
It's tissue.
Yeah. Like, the matter if, and I'm not asking any, like, if, whether you're religious, spiritual, or agnostic or atheist, when it doesn't, like, it's irrelevant to organ transplant. Mm-hmm. Like, all major religions, if you go on any, like, website and, like, reputable organ procurement agency website or a national transplant website, and it'll tell you, like, all major religions are in favor of organ donation because you're saving someone's life.
Yeah.
For me, weird things that I hear are, I don't hear that many weird things. For me, like, if I tell someone that I had if it comes up in conversation naturally, it's more of like, oh, they're surprised that happened to me. I think people actually, they don't ask this to me, but they'll probably wonder about life expectancy.
Mm.
you know, like, but no one's going to be like, oh, how long are you going to live? Like,
yeah.
Who's gonna, like, I mean, some idiot might say that to me, but like in general, I bet you that's a thing people think.
Mm-hmm.
Like limitations, like things like that. But I don't get a lot of the questions about the myths anymore. I think at this point, you know, thankfully most people in the U.S. are pro organ donation, but nevertheless, they're not like registered to be organ donors, which is the problem.
Yeah.
So I think most adults support organ donation, but, you know, I'm actually in front of a computer now here. So like 95% of U.S. adults support organ donation, but only 54% are actually signed up as donors.
Whoa. That's crazy. And it's probably also from people who don't even know they're not registered, like the same way people don't know they're registered to vote. I feel like people just wouldn't. Maybe you would be surprised.
Again, well, it's like when you go and renew your license, it's like somebody at the DMV is like, do you want to be an organ donor? Like, is that, that's probably like the one time that a lot of people like only know, you know,
mm-hmm.
no one's thinking about it. So, again, I hopefully people will register or think about it.
And you can do it online. Yeah. Like if you're not sure or you don't have a driver's license, you can just go online. There's a government website that'll take you to your specific state, I believe. If you just Google organ donation, I'm not going to, like, you know, talk down to you and give you the URL because I also don't know it. But if you just Google it, you truly can register online. It's super easy. I hope people will.
You've done far more research than I have.
I just know that you can Google it. And so I'm happy to share that information with everybody. It's so helpful.
No, it is. It's super easy. It's very easy. But I mean, again, as we're laughing, I'm saying 20 people die each day waiting for a transplant.
That's crazy. It's not funny. It's crazy. 20 people die just waiting. And there's so many.
Listen.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not scared of dying, but I don't want to die. Like, you know.
No. I mean, it's crazy. Yeah. And I also think you brought up a really good point, like talking with your family members, because that's such a stressful time. And if someone, you know, the doctor runs up and you're, God forbid, you're in the hospital and you can't speak for yourself and you're going, or you just went, and the doctor's like, okay, well, are they, you know, you don't want to like have to make a scrambled decision or an ethical or spiritual one in the moment. So like, let people know what you want when you're alive. Makes it easier.
Yeah. That makes it easier. And I don't mean to make light of this at all. And I do, you know, obviously we know each other through comedy and like, I like to joke around and we like to joke around, but it's very, that time it's such a crazy, interesting, like fascinating, like tragic time, like for both, like when the transplant happens, like when like someone's saving someone's life. So you have this team who's again in the intensive care unit, like trying to save somebody's life. Ultimately, they become brain death or whatnot, and then you know the transplant team comes in. It's just this amazing, beautiful thing. But at the same time, this family's all like is approached to make this decision because time is of the essence, you know. It's gotten better, like they've been able to preserve organs longer, like, you know, over the years, but it's this crazy situation. It's so crazy, even after, you know, almost 18 years, it's so crazy to me and so fascinating, interesting, and so remarkable. It's just a beautiful thing.
That's amazing. I am so glad you shared your story. I think people don't hear enough stories like this day to day, or honestly ever. Like, I don't know who's telling stories like this, but you don't hear a lot of them. You know, there's a lot of, I don't think, like, I feel like I don't walk around hearing about, it's just not one of those like popular causes. I don't know why. Feels like it should be,
you know. Yeah. And it's not a popular cause. It's not like, but it affects everyone.
Yeah.
Like, again, I think it's not like a singular population that it affects.
Yeah.
And it's also just, again, it's just saving a life. Like, it's
saving
so,
life.
It just seems so simple and so easy. And you know, honestly, it is one of those things that, you know, until it happens to you or someone you know, like, you honestly, you might not think about it. And that was my case. Mm-hmm. I was always registered as an organ donor, which I think I mentioned, but it obviously hit home to me when I got sick. This stupid like anecdote too, like one of my roommates in college, I just was thinking about this, who was very supportive of me early on, he had a hair transplant. As roommates, and he used to try and like claim that, like, he's like, hey, we're both part of the team, you know, we both had transplants. Like, I'm like, you're not part of the team. I'm like, you're not on the team. This is a true story. I swear to God. I'm like, you're not on the team.
Oh God!
Like, you just because you like went bald really young doesn't mean you and like decide to get a hair transplant.
Aren't hair transplants from your own body?
Yeah.
It's so crazy.
They like take it from the back.
They take it from your neck.
And like they put it. But it was this really funny joke. I'm like, you're not part of the team.
That is so funny. Oh my God.
Like, sometimes we'd like be sitting like watching TV as roommates, like he kind of like sort of looking at him like, you're not part of the team. I'm like, you're not part of the team.
Oh my God, that's so funny.
True story.
Also,
true
good for story. Him. And get roommate. That hair transplant in college. Go for it young. Just gotta like get ahead of it, you know? Wonder how it looks now.
He's bald.
Of course he is.
I'm
crying. Oh my God, Jesse, thank you for, you know, we're going to wrap up. And that's truly the kind of note this podcast has to end on. And also, just a reminder, everyone, register, make sure you register and have the conversations with your family. Make sure that they register. And any other parting words of wisdom after that?
Thanks, Janie, so much. I miss you. This podcast is great. Thank you so much.
Thank you for being on.
And thanks. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Forever Dog.
This has been a Forever Dog production. Executive produced by Brett Boehm, Joe Cilio, and Alex Ramsey. For more original podcasts, please visit foreverdogpodcasts.com and subscribe to our shows on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Keep up with the latest Forever Dog news by following us on Twitter and Instagram @ForeverDogTeam and liking our page on Facebook.